You're listening to Clause 8, the voice of IP. Today's episode, Patrick Kilbride and Brad Watts.
The IP system needs to facilitate dissemination of knowledge, disclosure, collaboration, and technology transfer throughout an ecosystem. You know, if we know that those are objectives, then we look at the set of rules and laws that have emerged, and we can course correct where necessary to make sure we're still pointing. So, you know, the purpose of doing these first principles is to provide a North Star so that we can recognize when we go off course.
That's so correct. I mean, again, it's about resetting the paradigm so that pro IP champions are operating from those same four corners. Even within the community of people who believe in strong IP rights, there are disagreements about specific ways to achieve outcomes.
Clause 8 is part of IP Watchdog and sponsored by Harrity, the go-to firm for the Patent 300 for patent preparation and prosecution. This is the final episode of Clause 8 for 2023. And from all of us at the Clause 8 team, we wish you and your family a happy holiday season. We'll be back in January with more episodes. But don't forget that between now and then, you can get caught up on any episodes you might have missed from this past season. And when you're looking through the archive, don't be afraid to leave us a review. It helps others find the show. We really appreciate your support. And now here's your host, Eli Mazur.
Today, we're lucky to be joined by Patrick Kilbride and Brad Watts from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce's Global Innovation Policy Center about their IP principles document. Thank you so much for joining Clause 8.
Thanks, Eli. Great to be here.
So Brad is a returning guest on Clause 8. We last spoke to him when he was helping Senator Tillis try to fix Section 101. We're glad you're back in this new role. Patrick has been at the chamber for, I think, almost 15 years. But, you know, whenever I see him speak at an IP event, I think he's one of the most unique and compelling advocates for America's IP system. I see when he starts talking, everybody, the room goes silent, everybody's listening in and holding on to his every word. And I think the way you communicate about why IP rights are important for America is very effective. And I'm glad to be able to share that with a Clause 8 audience. The IP principles document that I mentioned is, I think, part of a bigger initiative by the GIPC to help create a new narrative about IP rights. And full disclosure, you were kind enough to ask me to co-sign that document, and I was happy to do so. Brad, maybe before we dive into the discussion, what you're doing at the GIPC, maybe you could tell us, why did you decide to join Patrick at the GIPC in the first place?
A million-dollar question coming right out of the gate. Well, first off, I'm really glad to be back on with you again. I really valued our work together and our partnership when I was on the Hill, and it's great to be able to continue to work with you. Look, leaving Capitol Hill was a really hard decision for me. I had spent my entire career there, 8 years, 4.5 with Senator Tillis. When I say he was the best boss I had on the Hill, I mean, hands down, the way he empowered staff, the way he treated staff, the work he allowed us to engage in. You know, he is one of those rare members of Congress now who wants to be a legislator and accomplish big things. And it's hard to leave behind fulfilling work that allows you to make a real difference, not just on intellectual property, but, you know, in my last 2 years with him, he was either the author, co-author, one of the lead negotiators on 5 major bills that became law, everything from LGBTQ rights to guns to infrastructure to the CHIPS and Science Act. And so leaving such an influential legislator behind is hard, especially when he treats you like family. But like anything you love, sometimes you have to know when to let it go, when it's time to move on. And so I had been thinking for several months that it was time to pursue new interest. And I knew, though, that I wanted to continue my work in intellectual property. I wanted to work somewhere that made a difference, that was a thought leader. I didn't want to go just take any job. And then it was very fortunate. The stars aligned. The chamber was thankfully looking for someone to come in and do a lot of domestic IP work. And Patrick his boss, Tom Quadman, our boss, David Hirschman, they sold me on the chamber's mission, GIPC's mission, the mission of our members, and really convinced me that I could continue to do the great work I was doing on the Hill, but from a different angle in the private sector. And so I've told them this multiple times. Patrick has heard this multiple times, but they sold me as much as I think I had to sell myself in the interview process. And so I've loved every minute of it. I miss Tom Tillis dearly, but if you have to leave, there was kind of no better place to land initially than here at GIPC.
Patrick, before we dive into this initiative itself, can you just, I guess, share a bit about why you think IP rights are important?
Yeah, well, thanks, Eli. It's great to be here with you and Brad. Ever since I've been working on intellectual property policy, I've had one of the big benefits is interacting with thought leaders like you. And then, you know, having an opportunity to bring in a real legislative pro like Brad Watts really stepped up the game. It just makes it all much more fun for all of us to have that, you know, that caliber of professional as part of the team. And, you know, for IP, like you said, unique was an interesting choice of words, but I'll run with it. You know, my career has mostly been in international trade policy. You know, worked in the Bush administration for the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, came to the chamber and led their Western Hemisphere policy team for several years before coming over to the IP space. You know, when they recruited me to do IP, I said, look, and I'm not sure I'm the right guy. First of all, I'm not an attorney. I'm not an IP expert. You know, I've dabbled in it through the trade agreements. But, you know, I'm not even convinced. They said, give it 6 months. And sure enough, yeah, I immersed myself in.
And when you say you're not convinced, you weren't convinced about it.
Well, you know, at the outset, I wasn't necessarily convinced. You know, I knew it was important. I knew the stakes were very high, and that's what initially attracted me to the role. But it wasn't until I had the chance to immerse myself in it that I understood just how absolutely critical it was to our economic security, our national security. I mean, all these things that this principles document is about, it just crystallized for me that ownership is absolutely essential to investment. You know, and in an economy that over, a period of decades has transitioned from a largely physical, tangible economy to one that's vested in know-how and information and data flows, you have to be able to have ownership rights in intangible assets in order to be able to invest in those. And the intellectual property system is our means to make those investments and to create those assets. So to me, there's nothing more important in today's economy than getting IP policy right.
I think one of the goals of this new initiative is to create this new narrative of IP rights. I guess, Patrick, you've been doing this for a while, like you said. But what do you think is the current narrative?
We live in an era that has been marked by the emergence of a really strong trend of populist politics. And, you know, you see that in both parties, both political parties in the United States, where honestly, it feels like they've both fallen off a cliff and come together on the other side. You know, you actually hear the same narrative from Democrats and Republicans about corporate greed, about, you know, monopoly profits related to intellectual property, about corporate wokeism. And we know, and we've heard from American leaders for centuries now, that's not what intellectual property is about. Intellectual property is about enabling investment, facilitating creative expression, democratizing ownership and entrepreneurship. You know, so there's so many fundamental truths associated with IP that we would be all of us remiss in our duty if we allowed these false narratives to continue and left them uncontested.
Brad, you're the Capitol Hill expert, and you know, a weird experience that I had, completely two independent times. I met one time a congressman and one time a senator. They weren't Tom Tillis. And they found out I was a patent attorney. And the first two words out of their mouth were, patent troll! Like, they were trying to show me they knew what my job is about. It's about patent trolls. you've been on Capitol Hill a while. How do you think we got to that place?
That's such a good question, and it's so relevant to the whole point of this initiative, right? Because, I mean, you've heard me speak, Eli, before, back when I was on the Hill, right? Members of Congress are so incredibly busy, right? Even the most passionate members about intellectual property, like a Tom Tillis or a Representative Massey, they have to handle so many other crises day to day, right? Basic functions of the government, you know, foreign wars, you know, whatever may be going on. And so it's hard for members, particularly members who may not, you know, want to be the subject matter experts on IP, to know everything. But I think part of what has happened in intellectual property, and not just in patents, but as Patrick noted too in the debate around copyright and creativity, is that individuals who don't have the same views we have about intellectual property have over 10, 15, 20 years created a sustained narrative that, as Patrick noted, that somehow strong IP rights are connected with corporate greed, or that somehow strong rights for creators is going to lock up culture, or that patents only benefit big businesses. And we know that's not the case, right? IP rights are the ultimate social good, because it's what allows new ideas to come to market, products that make life better for everyday Americans, not just medical products, but think of all the modern technology we have, new movies, new books, new films. IP rights are critical, and especially for small businesses, IP rights are the ultimate democratizer. Why? Because they give them an ability to monetize their intellectual assets against competitors. But unfortunately, those who don't share that view have spent a long time creating a narrative that somehow IP rights are a hindrance to the social good. And so part of, and Patrick, please, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think part of what this initiative is about, and it's not just the Chamber of Commerce's initiative, it's meant to be an initiative from all the thought leaders in this community, people like you, other trade associations, academics, thought leaders, former government officials. But what this narrative is about is course correcting. And it's about us, the believers in a strong IP system, going on the offensive, setting the record straight, and making clear to policymakers in the world that no, these pillars of IP rights, national security, competitiveness, economic inclusion, these are going to be the things that ensure we remain not only the world's leader, but that we can continue to do what we do best, which is bringing those next big ideas and creations to market. So if anything, it's so appropriate that you brought that up, Eli, because in a microcosm, that's what this initiative is about. It's resetting the entire conversation and debate in a positive way that restores what Patrick noted was once the broad consensus about IP rights.
As Brad said, you know, we've been on this maybe anti-IP path or narrative for 15 to 20 years. Patrick, is there something, some event that kind of spurred the GIPC to tackle this initiative right now?
Yeah, I mean, great question. Let's take a step back and consider why this narrative, these false narratives emerged about, you know, corporate greed and patent trolls and monopoly profits. It's because of the rapid changes in technology and society and the failure of IP policy to keep pace and to recognize those changes. If for instance, a large segment of U.S. industry is treating patents defensively instead of, you know, investing in a portfolio for its own sake, for the sake of building assets, that's a canary in a coal mine, right? That tells us that we have a problem. If they're, you know, securing their most valuable intellectual assets through trade secrets instead of through the patent system, that tells us there's a problem. So we need to think about, you know, what are the ways that we can help patent policy? And it's really probably more in terms of patent administration, keep up with technology in order to provide that sort of streamlined, predictable, cost-effective means to secure a patent portfolio. And that means, you know, really good examination practices on the front end. It means investing in all the resources that USPTO and other IP authorities around the world would need to be able to really have a state-of-the-art administrative system. And then I think we'll see, you know, a drop-off in those in those perceived problems among industry stakeholders. But, you know, how did we get where we are in terms of the narrative and the rhetoric? Well, you know, you could point to, several judicial problems with, first of all, you know, with patent eligibility, with the loss of injunctive relief. You guys know this much, much better than I do, but that was a reflection. That was the courts telling all of us, the stakeholder ecosystem, that intellectual property law and administration had not kept up. That, you know, the courts were being forced to make policy because they were put in the position of resolving these disputes that really should be clarified on the front end. So, you know, the important thing for us is get the policy right, get the administration well-resourced, and then you'll avoid some of these problems on the back end. This narrative really has to go hand in hand with a hard look at the system itself and asking ourselves, is it, you know, fit for purpose for today's economy, or do we need to be a little bit more sophisticated going forward?
Anything recently, I guess, specifically happened that you think kind of spurred this?
We talked about the politics of the moment. I think there is a... there's been a culture building for a number of years that says, you know, information wants to be free, you know, and so it's sort of a skepticism about ownership of know-how. And our rejoinder to that is simply, you know, ownership rights matter in every segment of our society. You know, who would buy a car if you had to leave it out in the curb with the keys in it every night? Or what would you be willing to pay for it, right? You'd be willing to pay as much as, you know, it would cost you to have a car for a few hours, because that's what would happen. You know, by the same token, our innovators and creators aren't going to invest and take risk to bring something new to market if they can't have some ownership of the result. I think what we've seen is that we've lost the linkage between the P and intellectual property, right? The IP, it's the property ownership. And I think it's very regrettable that, the Supreme Court in oil states, for instance, weakened that connection further. If I could reinstate one thing with a magic wand, that might be it. Intellectual property is private property.
And I would just, if I can add on top of that, you know, I think Patrick is right. I mean, and I saw this on the Hill, a narrative built for years and years, and it was a sustained effort to treat all forms of intellectual property, right? Whether it was a copyright or a patent, as somehow locking up knowledge. But I think, as we know, right, I mean, the whole reason IP rights came into existence, and our good friend, you know, our collective good friend, Brian O'Shaughnessy, talks about this a lot in his speeches, is it was meant to break down the guild system, right? It was meant to break down this actual lockup of knowledge that prevented economic development and social mobility, right? The trade-off of IP rights is, yes, you get this property protection for a term, but then the world gets the benefit of your innovation, your creativity, of that knowledge being out there for the global betterment and good. And so I do think, you know, that aspect has been lost sight of, that by giving people strong property rights for a set term, we actually are democratizing the flow of information and not locking it up like it was in the gilded system of the medieval ages.
These points that he's making are vested in the principles document itself. You know, the intellectual property system provides a legal framework for collaboration. You know, it provides a means for would-be partners to come to the table and to agree on terms, because the property right enables you to associate a value with the product of your innovation or creativity. Without that, you know, there's no means for people to partner, at least on commercial terms. And likewise, you know, one of the real strengths of the U.S. system, especially, was that, you know, it did democratize intellectual property in the sense that it became available to everyone, right? And it was no longer, invention was no longer the hobby of the, you know, the aristocratic intellectuals. You know, it became something that everyday Americans could invest in. And then as we built out the system further, expanded that opportunity to, you know, individuals in all sorts of sectors. One of the things we're concerned about is that maybe we've lost a little bit of that because the system has become sort of overburdened by cost and litigation in ways that deny individuals, smaller businesses, you know, the ability to really effectively own and enforce intellectual property rights today.
One of the recent events that came to my mind when I was thinking about why now was this administration's decision to back the COVID IP waiver. And I know a lot in the anti-patent community, even people you'd associate with being less IP rights friendly, they were surprised by that occurring. What role did that play in your thinking about these principles? One theme through a principles document is obviously making sure that America is a leader on these issues on the global stage. So what did the COVID IP waiver, what kind of role did that play?
The elephant in the room, you know, the 800-pound gorilla, not the cause of this, you know, narrative that's gone off track, but really an outcome of a narrative that has gone way off course. But it really sort of made it crystal clear just how bad this problem had become. That, you know, leaders in the White House, you know, and in the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative could believe that it was a good idea to sacrifice American IP in the name of access to innovation. It really just flies in the face of everything we know about how the economy works. And it's sort of like the worst kind of wishful thinking that it is this idea that you could legislate wealth. You know, we'll just give it away to everyone. You know, what happens then is you just take the existing pie and divide it up into smaller and smaller pieces, each of which is worth less than they were to begin with. Instead of pursuing a policy that actually grows the pie, you know, stimulates innovation. One of the things that that I really like in the principles, it's probably lost a little bit in the preamble section, but we talk about, you know, when policy tries to defy market principles, it inevitably has the opposite effect of what's intended. And I think that's exactly what we see here. You know, the WTO IP commitment waiver is designed, in effect, to force technology transfer to developing countries so that they can manufacture critically needed products at home in their own market, which to me, that goal, that objective, that sounds pretty good. I do want, you know, African countries, for instance, to be able to manufacture vaccines and therapeutics and other critical technologies in their market, to be able to have the supply chains and distribution chains to get those to people quickly, you know, and safely. But we know that waiving intellectual property rights is not the way to get there. And that actually, among the countries that have the strongest intellectual property systems, you get the most partnership, the most technology transfer. It doesn't happen by, you know, taking the manual from Moderna and handing it over in whole cloth. It takes place organically throughout the ecosystem through these partnerships that are enabled by intellectual property. So the way to get to this goal of localizing this manufacturing capability, this innovation distribution capability, is through more IP, not less.
Have you gotten any pushback about the need for this initiative or any portions of the document? What's the reaction, Vince?
It's interesting. I think this flew below the radar screen for a little while. And it's only more recently that we've seen some of the, let's call them stakeholders who are less invested in the strength of the IP system, sit up and take notice. And in a refreshing way, I think we've seen some of those voices, sort of take a closer look and say, well, okay, maybe there's something here. Maybe we've gone too far, the pendulum swung too far in the other direction, and we need to reassess and return to first principles, which ultimately is what this is all about, right? So it's been an opportunity to re-engage, some of those skeptics on terms of common ground.
I think what's important about this initiative is, as Patrick noted, getting back to first principles, right? Resetting the paradigm, right? Nowhere in this document do we endorse specific bills, for example, or specific pieces of legislation. Instead, what this is about, and I think it's why it had so much broad support, is about making sure that when policymakers make decisions that impact IP rights, they're operating from those first principles, a paradigm of strong IP rights. Good policies around IP rights are critical to America's creative and innovative success. And that, to me, is the most important aspect of this, is, again, as Patrick noted, getting back to first principles, resetting the paradigm, making sure that when actions are taken, they're taken in the operative kind of sandbox of this paradigm. And so I'm very excited about resetting the narrative, very excited about resetting the paradigm, because ultimately having the right first principles, the right paradigm you're operating under, to me, leads to better policies.
Now, I want to talk about some of the themes in the document, and you obviously mentioned some of them. One being is what you're talking about is probably even more important for small and medium-sized businesses, inventors, startups, and so forth. You mentioned that it's even more important than to our larger partners. Talking to some of these independent vendors and startups, a lot of them have a sense, well, these larger companies succeeded because there was a strong patent system. And now they want to pull the rug under from the patent system so nobody can succeed like they did. And they might not refer to them as partners. Do you think it's a fair view about part of what's going on with the IP system?
I'll go back to a point I made a few minutes ago, which was this idea that if the patent system was really working for those large stakeholders the way it should, then they would continue to rely on it to protect their own assets. As it is, I think we see they've taken a more defensive approach. And they're really protecting critical assets through trade secrets. Now, there are some intellectual assets that aren't protectable by patents. There's others that probably are, but companies are making a decision whether or not to participate in that way. I think we need to look at the system itself and say, are there steps that we can take to make it more attractive? To hold those assets in terms of patents, to go through a disclosure. Part of that means giving better protection for regulatory data, for instance. So in the biopharmaceutical space, companies invest, probably the larger part of their investment in innovation goes towards proving that their products, their medicines that they're creating are safe and effective. And they develop proprietary data that proves that, they submit it to governments. And then in many countries, there's no legal protection at all for that data. If that was the case in many other industries, they had that same burden of regulatory proof. It might cause many of those industries to rethink their relationship with intellectual property, both the rights and the policy. You might see them become stronger advocates. So I think, as we look at the types of intellectual assets that companies are creating today, let's think about how we make them more protectable and create the incentives for them to be full participants.
One dynamic I see is that some of these larger companies do say that, we'll only use our patent portfolio defensively. but when they actually face a business situation where somebody steals their IP rights, or they feel like somebody maliciously, an employee leaves and kind of steals their technology, they're more than happy to enforce whatever rights they might be able to enforce. Do you think some of these companies are being short-sighted about the benefits of having strong IP rights? And Brad, do you have any thoughts about that? They do need these moral partners. They do need these startups. They do need these innovators to thrive on the global stage.
You know, I'll kind of harken back to what Patrick said, and I think it's so apt, right? And Tillis, when I was with him, used to talk about this all the time, right? That businesses, by and large, right, can't operate in the world of what we would like to see, right? They can't build a 20-year business plan around here's where we hope the legal system is going to be, right? They are operating day to day, quarter to quarter, trying to pay the bills, especially your SMEs, right? Pay their employees, meet payroll, invest in that product, you know, potentially losing money for 6, 7, 8 years while they try to bring that product to market. And so, you know, I think as Patrick noted, you know, for many of these companies, if the system is not working for them, big or small, it's hard to, you know, judge them or try to tell them to change their strategies, right? I think what we have to make sure is that the IP system is actually working. It's working for businesses. It's working for individuals. It's working to bring about that knowledge transfer by giving people strong IP rights in exchange for bringing that knowledge to the public. I think if you do that, right, you make the system work the way we intended it, those behaviors can and may change. But I think it's hard to assign motive or judgment to many swaths of businesses when, you know, for them, their biggest priority is meeting that payroll at the end of the day so that their employees can go home, provide for their families. And, you know, they have to live in a real world, not the world of what we may do 10 years from now.
When you think about what are some of the challenges we see within the system today, and what is it especially that creates conflict between, you know, the views of one segment of industry and another, for instance, or between, you know, the interests of small businesses and larger incumbent stakeholders? It's the questions of legal certainty, predictability, transparency, you know. And so we're investing a lot of our effort in terms of thinking about how do we set the terms on the front end to create that transparency and predictability, that reliability of the right, and take some of the pressure off the back end. Because, you know, if we're always arguing about, you know, the questions that come up after the fact, after a patent has been granted, then you're, you know, inevitably putting all the burden on investments that have already been made. We want people to be able to look at the system going in and say, if I make this investment, and if I'm successful, that I can trust that the system will support my rights, that I'll have, you know, the exclusivity, the enforceability, you know. And then just like, you know, if you buy a piece of land, you know, you're doing the due diligence beforehand, you know, to take care of that title. And then afterwards, you know, there may be an occasion where your land ownership's contested, but it's really rare and exceptional circumstances. We need to be able to get to that kind of circumstance in the intellectual property system where, you know, invalidating a patent would be, you know, a surprise to people that, no, this shouldn't be just par for the course.
Another important theme, I think, of the document is about the importance of IP rights for national security. And I think that's self-evident, at least to me. But I think the counter-argument that you hear is, well, these evil regimes like China and so forth will take advantage of our strong IP rights. They will flood the USPTO with applications for trademarks. They're getting more patents than American companies in areas X, Y, and Z. And they're going to be able to enforce those rights against American companies. But, you know, realistically, American companies won't be able to do that in China. What is your response to that? Do you think there's any truth to that, those concerns?
You know, when we think about China, the main difference that I think of is in terms of the law, right? And in China, what you see is rule by law. And in the United States, what we've predominantly seen is rule of law. You know, and what's the difference? You know, both countries have extensive, you know, legal frameworks, statutes, regulation, administrative authority, law enforcement. In China, you know, that may work as would be expected 99% of the time, but in that one case out of 100 where the government wants a different outcome, you sort of expect that they'll put their thumb on the scale. And that's rule by law, right? They're manipulating the laws to get the state's desired outcome. In a rule of law environment, you don't know what the outcome is going to be, but you know that the laws are transparent, they're predictable, that, you know, when there is a dispute, that there will be due process, and that there's a system in place that allows you to work through it. I think restricting rights in our own country in order to combat China's, you know, rule by law problem only weakens our own strengths. You know, you think about what the United States does so well. You know, we compete, we enable failure, we provide a rule of law environment, we make markets. China tries to do all those things from the top down. If we make ourselves more like China, we're not going to beat China. We beat China by doing more of what America does better.
And I'll just add 2 points there. I mean, first, you know, Eli, you brought up trademarks. You know, I'm a firm believer if there are truly bad practices going on, Congress can and will act quickly. And I look at the Trademark Modernization Act, which was passed in 2020. You know, that happened because my good friend, Jamie Simpson, who at the time was chief counsel for the House Judiciary IP Subcommittee, she heard there was a problem. She listened. She put together a bipartisan coalition. And in one congressional session, which is almost unheard of, we were able to pass a law to crack down on abuse. But to Patrick's point, that's not a reason, though. Trying to fix a bad problem isn't a reason to weaken the whole system for everyone, right? You fix the bad problem. But to me also, you see this in the document, but also it's a fundamentally of who do we want setting the global standards for new and emerging technologies. And I think about the internet, right? Part of why we have today a free and open internet that has done so much good for the economy, for society, for human rights, for the dissemination of information, is because the United States, where, you know, the internet was developed, right, where our companies took the lead, we set the standards early on of free speech, freedom of dissemination, a free and open internet. And, you know, Andrei Iancu has talked about this quite a bit, right? You know, in the technologies of the future, quantum, artificial intelligence, do we want the United States setting the standards for those technologies? And I think what I would argue, and many of our member companies would argue, is yes, that our standards, as Patrick noted, comply with the rule of law, right? And a legal framework that is free and fair and open. And it may not always lead to the results you like, but it is predictable.
Brad, you mentioned that it's unfair to hold it against companies for operating under the system as it is, right? And some would argue that efficient patent infringement makes good business sense. One of my previous guests, Dan Brown, the inventor of a bionic wrench, he made, I think, somewhat a provocative argument, but saying, you know, there's criminal penalties for copyright infringement. You know, back when there's people use VHS tapes, you were warned that if you commit copyright infringement of FBI will come after you. You know, people watch that and say, you know, I'm not going to do that. If you're an executive at a publicly listed company, you're not going to break the law and so forth when it comes to copyright infringement. But then efficient infringement for patents, you know, that just makes good business sense and nervous sense it is. And his proposal is, well, should there be criminal penalties for willful patent infringement to kind of at least give executives who want to behave ethically and so forth, a good business reason to do so. Any thoughts about criminal penalties for patent infringement?
So I think I'll do a dodge on that one, but I will say, just to correct the record, you know, what Senator Tillis, you say is many businesses, right? Because look, in any context, there's always going to be people who are engaged in bad acts, right? And you brought up fraudulent trademarks, right? There are bad actors, you know, in the system. We see it with counterfeits, right? We see it with other business decisions. But for many businesses, right, they are trying to do the right thing. They're trying to act ethically, right? But they have to operate in the business environment that they're in, not the business environment that may or may not appear legislatively. Because I want to be abundantly clear, in no way does Senator Tillis, at least when I was with him, support the idea of efficient infringement as a legitimate or lawful business tactic.
Right, right. And but
you, I don't want to get a call from the senator later today.
But do you think that's a problem that a lot of businesses do see that? I'm guessing you do think it's a problem. But do you think that's the reality of the situation, that businesses do see efficient infringement as making good business sense right now?
You know, I'm curious Patrick's thoughts on it as well. It's always hard to say hypothetically, right? I mean, I'm sure there are bad actors out there, right, who are wanting to do bad things and not act ethically in business. I think part of how we curb that, right, though, is, as Patrick noted, we return intellectual property rights to a place where they're strong, they're protected, they're viewed as property, and where, just like any other property right, you can enforce that right and prevent the unauthorized use. You know, how we do that in the 21st century, I think, you know, as Patrick noted, is the challenge, right? How do we make the IP system work for the 21st century? But I think if you do that, you, for that small minority of bad actors, right, you crack down on their ability to even justify that as a business decision. That's just my kind of off-the-cuff assessment.
So, Patrick, maybe I'll ask the question a little bit more broadly. Some patent owners, they look at the IP system as it is, and they say, well, it's actually working pretty well for the copyright owners, for trademark owners. You know, like I mentioned, for copyright, there's criminal penalties. For trademark infringement, you could still get injunctions. But for patent owners, you know, it's much harder to enforce their patents. You know, maybe if you have a lot of resources and you're willing to deploy those resources, maybe you'll get some relief down the line. And the adjacent argument to that is, well, patent rights is really what you need the most capital investment in, right? To drive all that research and development, the creative arts and the brand development, you know, companies and individuals will still do that and kind of navigate that. But to do that intensive R&D, you really need a stable and predictable system. Do you think there's a discrepancy?
I don't agree with that premise at all. I think in many ways, the risks facing IP owners in the creative and brand areas are every bit as intensive as those facing patent owners. You know, maybe, and it's not always a matter of absolute numbers, right? You know, compare a pharmaceutical company that may invest a couple of billion dollars in bringing a new drug to market versus an individual. You know, maybe it's a young woman with a great voice who is investing herself in a music career. In either case, you know, if your intellectual property is violated, it can have, you know, massive implications for your own well-being of the firm on one hand, and its innovation, the well-being of you know, the individual on the other. And what we see is that intellectual property rights, in the case of some of these individual creators especially, is what turns creativity from a hobby, a side gig, side hustle, to a career, you know, where you're actually able to invest in yourself. You wonder why, you know, the U.S. produces so many of the movies that the world wants to watch, so much of the music that the world wants to listen to. Is it because, you know, our people are just inherently more creative? Or is it that we have a system that enables them to invest in their own talent, develop that talent, and make a livelihood from it? So, you know, across all forms of IP, we need that strong legal certainty to enable the investment. You know, when you talk about patent troll behavior, when you talk about efficient infringement behavior, I sort of take it as a given that that activity happens. Because as Brad said, you know, the reality is there are unethical people out there who will take advantage of any situation. This is why we have rules and we have laws, right, is to prevent those. I think in both cases, both sides of that coin, the patent troll behavior and efficient infringement is likely to take place when there's enough uncertainty in the system that it creates, you know, an opportunity for the bad actors to take advantage. And I think we have to look and try to take some of that uncertainty out. I actually think, the rise of AI can be a real tool for that. So in the patent space, for instance, you know, if you're in any given sort of fields of technology and you were able to know exactly where the cutting edge is and exactly how one patent related to another, then you could predict with some certainty, you know, how one patent would stand up against another. And I think, certainly the companies that we represent at the chamber, they're not going to engage in efficient infringement as a willful strategy because of the liability that would create. You know, they would be in violation of their fiduciary responsibility to their shareholders if they did that. So for a legal counsel to actually recommend that, I have a difficulty seeing that happening. But does that kind of behavior happen? Probably so, because the uncertainty of the system right now makes it possible. By the same token, you know, this assertion of patents that, you know, they might mean what this guy's doing or they might not, they're subject to interpretation. I think that we need more clarity in the system.
I mean, do you agree with the premise that there's a disparity in the ability to enforce patent rights versus other types of IP rights right now?
You know, I think there are real challenges to being able to enforce patents. But by the same token, you know, ask anybody in the creative space, you know, how challenged they are by AI that's, you know, training on their creative works.
Good point.
And ask them about, you know, fair use doctrines and how, you know, that's being expanded to allow, you know, ever increasing, use of and creation of derivative works from copyrighted content. I think they tell you they, in fact, that's kind of the premise of GIPC, right? Is we've got the advanced manufacturing and technology sitting next to recording industry and movie studios sitting next to, biopharmaceutical innovators. And they all have very similar problems.
I would agree with that, too. I mean, and I'll just point out a concrete example from my time on the Hill, you know, brand integrity, right? I remember when I was with Senator Tillis, you know, we had retailers coming to us talking about the real surge in counterfeits that they're seeing. Because as you probably know, Eli, right now, customs, they can't seize a product for violating a design patent, right? Or violating the design. They can seize an infringing trademark. And I remember one apparel retailer told me what they've seen is essentially these counterfeiters. They are now separating the false trademark from the actual physical product. And the false trademark can be seized. The infringing physical product can't. So whatever gets through, they'll then just attach the false logo to and then sell. And so I think to Patrick's point, maybe we don't hear as much about some of the challenges other types of IP protections are facing, but they do.
To be fair, I definitely don't hear. I mostly speak to people in the patent world. So that's I'm glad. That's why I wanted to ask you that. So that's very interesting. All right, you know, one thing that you did mention is that, you know, when you were coming up with these principles, you didn't adopt any specific policy ideas. You know, you kind of wanted to start this conversation, create this new shared maybe principles. Talking about the patent system now, is there anything that kind of stands out to you in terms of What can be done to better align America's patent system with these IP principles?
Yeah, you're probably, you and Brad are certainly the legal experts, and I am not. My background's in economics. What I would say is the reason we don't have a policy prescription attached to this document is that we want it to be a reminder that all of the patent law, copyright law, trademark law, trade secret law for that matter, that makes up our intellectual property system, including the sort of the executive, legislative, executive, and judicial branches of government and the roles they play. It's all discretionary. They came up over many, many decades, couple of centuries with this set of rules. But those are not necessarily the right rules. What we're trying to say is, whatever the rules are, these are the outcomes that we need to be able to get to. We need to, the IP system needs to be a reliable basis for investment in high risk, capital intensive, long-term projects that lead to innovative and creative outcomes. The IP system needs to facilitate dissemination of knowledge, disclosure, collaboration and technology transfer throughout an ecosystem. If we know that those are objectives, then we look at the set of rules and laws that have emerged, and we can course correct where necessary to make sure we're still pointing. So, the purpose of doing these first principles is to provide a North Star so that we can recognize when we go off course.
That's so correct. I mean, again, it's about resetting the paradigm so that pro IP champions are operating from those same four corners. Because as you know, Eli, I mean, we talked about this, as recently as, a couple of weeks ago, is even within the community of people who believe in strong IP rights, there are disagreements about specific ways to achieve outcomes, right? That's normal. We all have our own backgrounds, perspectives, intellectual takes on things. But as Patrick noted, what we're trying to do here is to say to policymakers, to the broader legal community, you may disagree on the specifics, but here's what should guide you. And here's, as Patrick noted, the outcomes we want to see achieved: a strong, robust IP system that promotes that transfer of knowledge and allows people to do what they do best, to create and invent that next big thing.
I want to take a step back and talk about, I think you talked about, obviously in doing this effort, you've tried very hard to bring in as many voices, as many groups as possible, bring them together and get behind this initiative. But the GIPC, which is part of the USC Chamber of Commerce, is leading it thanks to you. Brad, you just mentioned there's a lot of different views on IP, right? Whether it's something even the government should be focused on fixing right now and so forth. And all these different companies make up the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Why does Chamber of Commerce have a GIPC, have an intellectual property center? Why is it one of those rises to that level of importance that it's Chamber of Commerce has its own center focused on that?
The Chamber of Commerce is all about free enterprise and promoting the free enterprise system. And, that looks a little bit different in different different spaces, but across all of them, there are some principles that apply, right? It's that you allow market participants, which is all of us, right, to create value and to assign value through the economic decisions we make every day. So, I'm a huge fan of, Adam Smith and David Ricardo, but one of my pet peeves is David Ricardo's notion of this invisible hand. I always say, that's BS. It's actually, 8 billion very visible hands, actually 16 billion, right? Because we all got two of them. It's people acting every day, making economic decisions about what's good for them and their families, and then assigning a certain value. You assign a value to quality time with your kids. You assign a value to the food you get at the grocery store. You assign a value to the hours of labor that you're willing to devote to your work. And the chamber is essentially all about creating the environment where those values can be represented in our economy, that where we're allowing individuals, firms, other market participants to make those decisions and act on the basis of the value that they give and they receive. And the premise is that when governments interfere, it actually reduces the social welfare of everyone. In an economy where, we're not just digging in the ground for, nuts and seeds, where we're actually adding intellectual value, you have to be able to apply those same market principles to intellectual labor as you would to physical labor. That's why there's a GIPC.
You'd agree that the PAN system has gotten weaker in a lot of ways over the last 15 to 20 years. But I guess with one array, the ability of PAN owners to enforce their rights right now has been litigation funding. And PAN owners argue that it puts them on a level playing field with who they think infringes their PAN rights. Do you think there's a role for litigation funding for enforcing IP rights? Or do you think there are better solutions out there?
Well, so the chamber actually has an active effort to fight litigation funding abuses. Now, the devil's in the details, right? Well, what is abusive and what is not? To the extent that there's evidence that foreign actors are funding litigation in order to game, the U.S. system or to access, trade secrets in discovery, then that type of problematic behavior should be fought, and the chamber is leading on that. To the extent that it's as you put it, sort of evening the playing field when less well-resourced, IP owners are forced to defend their rights against challengers with deeper pockets, I think that point kind of makes itself as well. What Brad and I have tried to do is to keep that conversation focused on what does abusive behavior look like. You could say the same about, patent trolls versus other, legitimate forms of patent assertion. How do we describe a spectrum of behavior and identify the extremes? On one end, this perfectly legitimate, unquestioned, right to assert, and on the other hand, sort of willy-nilly cease and desist or demand letters, against people who may not be infringing at all. And the same is true of patent litigation funding. You have to look at the spectrum of behavior that you see, identify the extremes, and then sort of work to the middle to figure out where you can draw some lines.
Patrick's so right. I'll just reiterate, asserting your rights is not in and of itself an abusive behavior, right? And I do think one of the narratives about patent trolls is that, if you assert your rights and try to litigate them, you're automatically a troll. And I think that's incorrect, right? Behavior can be abusive. Context matters, but simply owning a right and wanting to assert it doesn't make you an abusive actor.
Brad, as part of this process of putting this document together, you've talked to a lot of stakeholders about the IP system, heard their concerns. Flexion, you probably, you've been kind of at the epicenter of of a different, slight difference of opinions and so forth. Is there anything that kind of surprised you or any kind of takeaways going through this experience of putting this document together that sticks out to you?
What I will say, and first, again, this was an idea, an initiative that was in the works long before I joined the chamber. I'm just privileged that I got to work on it as one of my first big projects. But, I welcome Patrick's perception as well. But, I was actually very surprised at the high degree of consensus. Even within industries that you think might normally disagree, there seemed to be, at least at a broad paradigmatic level, an understanding that things aren't trending in the right way in terms of the public policy narrative around property ownership, intellectual assets. And I think what I was also impressed with is, again, with such a diverse group of partner organizations and individuals, plenty of people had differences of opinions or may have wanted to edit it or add something into the document. And what I found so, again, fascinating is people were so ready and willing to quickly resolve those and figure out common ground and consensus. And I think that's just a testament to the fact that by and large, there's a recognition that the narrative has been going in the wrong way. And even if people don't agree on the specific policy outcomes to achieve the, you know, the first principles we've articulated, there seems to be very broad agreement that we need to get back to these first principles. So to me, it was a pleasant surprise.
Patrick, anything surprise you?
I will be surprised in a positive way by just how enthusiastic the response was from the broader IP community to this project. You know, as Brad said, we had a great dialogue with a lot of different thought leaders, academics, other business organizations about what precisely the language of the principles should be. But everyone was universally receptive and enthusiastic to the idea of doing this project. And they certainly recognized that in broad scope, you know, those sort of core pillars that we've identified in terms of, you know, national security, innovation leadership, creative expression, you know, enforceability and accountability and diversity and inclusion, that those were the right pillars. And so that was very gratifying, I'm sure, to me, but maybe most especially to Brad, because he really was the one who took the pen for us and, you know, set us down this path.
What are the next steps? And how will you know if this initiative has been successful, that the narrative has been reset?
Well, it's a, you know, times like this is the next step, Eli, you know, talking to thought leaders like yourself who have a platform that can help get the word out. You know, we're doing together with other co-signers in academia and industry, doing op-eds, incorporating these principles into our talking points for panel discussions and presentations. Ultimately, you know, taking the principles to Capitol Hill and to the White House. You know, and I could see, you know, frankly, Brad and I made a conscious decision up front that this principles document was focused on the U.S. because we thought, you know, as Americans, it's our responsibility to get it right at home. But ultimately, you know, these are kind of principles that, you know, we would seek to apply in our international advocacy down the road.
And I'll just add to, you know, our goal, as Patrick noted, is we're getting thought leadership out there. We're talking with people like you. We're getting people to raise this on the circuit, you know, the circuit that we all participate in. But hopefully at the start of 2024, we want to take this on the roadshow up to Capitol Hill, to the agencies, and we want to start rebuilding that cadre of champions who, even if they disagree on the specific policy proposal, a specific bill or piece of legislation, they're still operating again from these same first principles. Because I do think that's how you correct the narrative, right? Is you build that cadre of policymakers, thought leaders, administrative officials who, even if they disagree on the specifics, they're operating from the same core place. And I think that's ultimately how we'll reset the narrative, change the trend, and hopefully direct IP rights into the area we all want to see them go, which is strong, predictable, and providing that social good.
After this is successful, after we reset the narrative, and you go up to a random congressman or a senator who's not steeped in these issues, and you say, trademark, copyright, patents, what do you want the reaction to be to hearing that?
America's competitive advantage.
To me, it would be just one sentence. It's, you know, I believe strong IP rights are critical to America's future, and I'm for anything that's for strong IP rights. You know, they don't have to get in the specifics, they don't have to get in the weeds, but if that's their initial gut reaction anytime they're looking at an IP bill or hearing about IP, to me, that's a win.
This has been great. Anything else that you want Clause 8 podcast listeners to take from this conversation, from these principles? They hear this, and I'm sure a lot of them are excited about this reset that your initiative that you started.
Yeah, I love the title of your podcast, because it is a reminder that the roots of American IP are in the U.S. Constitution, and that the founders of the country, you know, who gave so much thought, you know, at a time of, you know, enlightenment, the age of reason, they knew intuitively that intellectual property was critically important to the country that they were seeking to build. And so today, I think we owe it to that, you know, American spirit to preserve the system that has made the U.S. the global leader in technology, in liberty, in market economic led prosperity, and so it's very appropriate that we're here with you, Eli, on Clause 8 talking about this.
I just have two things. I mean, first, I would just say to all of your listeners, this document is not closed. We need more supporters. If you're out there listening to this, and this sounds like an initiative you want to support, please reach out to us. Again, this is, you know, not a Chamber of Commerce initiative. This is a collective initiative between all of us who care about strong IP rights. So if you're out there and you're listening and you want to become engaged with us, reach out, shoot us an email. We're looking for more partners to help reset the narrative. And then, you know, I'll just close with, because I'm, you know, kind of a philosophy person at heart. You know, these ideas, you know, are ancient ideas, right? The idea that knowledge is to the benefit of humankind. You know, if you look at Hermeticism, right, which is rooted all throughout, you know, Western society, you know, religion, philosophy, et cetera. You know, one of the earliest Hermetic ideas is that pursuit of knowledge is actually the pursuit of the divine and an understanding of God. And so this idea that, you know, strong rights, however they've been termed throughout history, are somehow antithetical to human growth or development. I mean, I would argue that going back to the foundation of, you know, Western civilization, there has been a realization that ideas, creativity, innovation is actually inherently a core part of, you know, mankind's journey. So I don't think what we're trying to do is anything new. I think what we're trying to do is undo abnormal trends from the last 20, 25 years.
Well, thank you so much, Brad and Patrick, for sharing your wisdom and for coming on the Clause 8 podcast.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for listening to Clause 8, the voice of IP. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with others and leave us a 5-star rating in your favorite podcatcher. We'd also like to thank Harity & Harity LLP for their generous support. And a reminder, this is our final episode of 2023. We'll be back with more episodes in January. For more information, visit voiceofip.com. And don't forget to check out our full archive of previous episodes. Clause 8 is a Brouhaha audio production. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.